Welcome to Politics Unlocked, a weekly podcast where we discuss political news and events every Friday. It's Friday, the 27th of November. My name is Chris Wilson, and joining me again this week from his YouTube channel, A Different Bias, his name is Phil, and he likes to talk about politics. It's Phil Morehouse. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm all right, thanks, Chris. How are you?
I'm not too bad. So you know, Phil, that last week I gave the email address out of the podcast, which is show@politicsunlocked.uk. Would you believe it? We had hundreds of unsolicited emails. Unfortunately, they were all telling us how hardworking Priti Patel is. So the news today, as we record, is really around the post-lockdown COVID tiers. So the position that everywhere is going to be in after our current lockdown lifts. And it is pretty easy to describe. As before we recorded, you described it as the Isle of Wight and one other place in tier one.
There's Isle of Wight, Cornwall and the Isle of Scilly. So, you know, the bottom bit of England that, with all respect to people who live there, not a lot of people go to, except on the holidays, but that isn't really a thing at the moment.
And 99% of the population in tier two or tier three.
Yes.
Notable discussion points are that London and Liverpool are in tier two, but the likes of Manchester are in tier three. The Checker postcard website crashed immediately, which seems fitting.
But that's fine. I mean, I've got the list in front of me of regions because, I mean, it's effectively done by region. You're in the south of England. Again, there's some exceptions, but you are in tier two.
It's interesting because concern around the tiers does vary, as you said, depending on where you are, because in the likes of Manchester, for example, Andy Burnham has raised concerns around the level of support for business in tier three areas. He's talked, for example, about the fact that it doesn't take into account the number of people who might work in the hospitality sector in a city, for example, when it comes to the support that they can draw down, or the businesses in a tier two area that might rely on other businesses in a tier three area. In other words, they wouldn't qualify for the same level of support, but they might be just as affected.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if this government actually understood anything about the supply chain, then we wouldn't really be going ahead with Brexit, but there it is. This interconnectivity is completely absent from the thinking of our current government.
Now, although we've heard a lot about tiers over the last while, given that the messaging has been not exactly the clearest, it's worth outlining what the difference in tiers actually is. So as far as I understand it, under all the tiers, all non-essential shops can reopen, as can gyms and hairdressers and other businesses. But the rule of six will apply for outdoor gatherings, and it varies then depending on which tier you're in. So it's the same for indoors and outdoors in tier one, but in tier two and three, it can only happen outdoors. And in tier three, it can only happen in a park or a public space. And in tier two and three, you can't mix households, except potentially during Christmas when we expect that the rules will change, although that hasn't been fully announced. And then there's differences in terms of hospitality businesses. So in tier two, alcohol can be served only with a substantial meal, while in tier three, all pubs and restaurants and cafes must close except for delivery and takeaway. Substantial meal is a funny one because it became a bit of a meme. Since March in Ireland, the substantial meal qualification has been in place, and so the euphemism for going to the pub has become I'm going for a substantial meal.
Yeah, they've tightened up a little bit. The tiers were worthless before. Essentially, tier one was you have to leave the pub at 10 p.m. Tier two was you're not allowed to go to your mate's house after the pub to have a vodka. And tier three was if you want to go to the pub, you have to have a pie. That was basically how it seemed to work. Whereas now they've toughened it up a bit. And the other problem, the problem where, as I say, I worry about it, because the, although if you look at the number of daily new cases now over time, you look at the average, it's coming down. So you can say, well, from the limited data that I can get access to, you could say, well, okay, this could be the impact of the lockdown such as it is, but the number of new daily cases is still a lot higher than when the scientists were first calling for the lockdown. At that time, we were on about 4,000 new cases a day, which meant in reality it would be much higher than that, but that's just what was known. Now it's still on about 19,000 a day. So we're still in a worse position when the scientists said we're in a really bad position and need a lockdown. And then you've got people as well confused because they're saying to themselves, well, hang on a minute. Before the lockdown, I was in tier two. After the lockdown, I'm now going to be in tier three. The lockdown was supposed to make things better. So how come I'm in a more severe tier? And the reason is, of course, there's you're comparing apples with oranges because the tiers were very different. They were useless before. They were virtually useless. The lockdown itself, although seems to have done some good, it could all be wiped away again by coming out of it too early, which it looks like we will do. And I mean, from my point of view, I notice no difference. So the only time I'm out and about, really, apart from walking the dogs, we don't see that many people anyway, is driving to the supermarket each week and driving to and from the college, which is some distance away, where I do a bit of part-time work. And I noticed no reduction in traffic. I thought I did on one day, but it must have been a coincidence because every other day it's still been really busy on the roads.
So you think that the tiers or that this lockdown isn't having a massive effect, so that doesn't bode well for the potential of the tiers afterwards then?
It was always known that this lockdown was not as severe as the first lockdown, so it was going to need longer. And it's not been given longer because Boris Johnson has probably done politically what he could do. He has, you know, I've sort of described it as he sees it as a negotiation. It's like the scientists say we need to do this. OK, that's your negotiating position. The lunatics in his party who don't even want to wear a mask say another thing and he tries to compromise. So he says to the lunatics, look, the scientists really want this. How about we do this halfway house, as if that.
I did see, for example, we're seeing a sort of a fracturing in terms of support from even from the Conservative Party. So, for example, Matt Hancock was asked, I forget by whom, whether there was an appeals process. We're seeing, for example, Anne-Marie Morris, who's a Conservative MP, saying that she's disappointed to see Devon placed in tier two. So we have MPs not only disappointed that they're in the highest tier, but also that they're in tier two and they feel like they should be in tier three. And then we have some suggestion related to that it should be divided up at a more local level. So rather than having these large regions under restrictions when certain areas would have some of the lowest cases and certain would have some of the highest. But, you know, then it becomes a practical discussion about what's possible. As you said, that all gets mixed into then the political discussion, because we have the coronavirus response group. I think I described them last week as the coronavirus research group, but they're the faction within the Conservative Party, and they seem to be against certain restrictions from an ideological perspective. So it's up in the air whether the vote next week. Could go through. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It will go through because it will go through again with Labour votes. The Tory rebellion is growing. I mean, there comes a point where if the Tory rebellion was large enough, then Boris Johnson wouldn't want to go ahead with the vote because although he would get it through, it would enrage the MPs who are against it that he's effectively working with Labour on it, because that would be what's happened. Labour will absolutely support it, not only because they are in favour of following whatever measures the government is willing to put in place that are scientifically advised, at least, but also politically, it does them no harm at all to see the Conservative Party split along these lines.
Yeah.
But it's... Yeah, I mean, what really should happen is this thing should have been managed at a local level. Local authorities should have been given the resources to do it. They would have been able to identify flare-ups, even down to housing estates or individual schools, and be able to deal with it with local knowledge and local resources, at which point it would never have got up to the point it has now. Whereas the problem is it's all being controlled from London. So of course they can't manage it on such an incremental level from Downing Street.
Yeah, and what you alluded to earlier on, which is the fact that the cases, the level of cases we're at now are higher than when the lockdown was first called for. And that's a running issue with our response to COVID in terms of putting the restrictions in place, is that we're always arguing in a sense in the least ideal situation, because it's always, well, if we'd done it properly, we could be talking about it this way and this way and this way.
Yes.
But we never are. So we're always sort of on the back foot. And talking about this sort of, well, this is not an ideal situation, and that's always our starting point. So it has to go back really, to some extent, from on the lack of action and the willingness to make it a political discussion, as you said, a negotiation between the.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that part of the reason for the delay, I mean, part of it can be down to the fact that Boris Johnson is so indecisive, but part of it could be that it's taken him weeks to get agreement from enough of his MPs that it doesn't split the party, or that he just feels that the situation has to get so bad that those MPs have to be effectively muted so they don't cause too much trouble. Which is the only way to explain the fact that it took a month and a half after scientists said you now need another lockdown because you didn't listen to us in August, that it took a month and a half for them to actually finally do that.
Yeah, now we see stories, albeit, speculation, but probably informed speculation about a third wave. Now, of course, the newspaper wants to sell newspapers, but there is that sense constantly that when we don't do exactly what we should do, when we should do it, we're always putting on a band-aid. As you said, we don't even know if this lockdown is going to have been
Mean,
effective.
so the waves will happen anyway. I mean, Japan is in its third wave, but its waves are really, really small compared to ours. The bottom line is that we are unlikely that, although people are looking forward to the vaccine being rolled out, the time it will take for that to have enough effect means there is, every chance that there is going to be a third wave before that. And the vaccine doesn't do anything about these waves. It's a preventative, it's not a treatment.
And I did see, was it Chris Whitty who was talking about,
He was talking today.
emphasizing that point that, even when the vaccine comes, it's not going to suddenly stop. And that is a concern, I think. We talk about a while ago about how the strictness of public health messaging was important, and how when everything was very clear and we had a very clear message, we were able to maintain this very cohesive, very clear strategy for a while, and as soon as that broke, it broke. And there's also a concern potentially that the messaging around the vaccine, although people need a hopeful message, how it's delivered could give people a false sense that they don't have to be as concerned, when actually right
Yeah,
now
well,
the risk
the
is
problem.
as high as ever.
Yeah, the problem is the way the media presents it, and the health secretary has done nothing to counter this, is they keep talking about it as one, it's more imminent than it really is. Matt Hancock was quite happy to say that the NHS is going to be ready to roll this vaccine out from December. Now, what he means by that is, were the vaccine to be available, then the NHS is in a position to do that. But that gives the impression, oh, we're going to start rolling it out in December. No, we're not. And the papers are also, yes, they're talking up just how the likes of the Daily Express are the worst, but other media as well, exaggerating just how quickly the rollout's going to be, and they're not really cautioning people that it's not going to be that fast, and also it takes quite a long time before you're protected anyway. You have to have two doses, and the way it works with at least one of the vaccines, I don't know about the Oxford one, although it was interesting, the Oxford one turns out that the success of it was down to a cock up, but there we go, that happens in science sometimes. They found out that, so if they give half a dose for the first inoculation, it works better And then they only found this out because they accidentally gave a test group half a dose for the first one. They didn't mean to. And they realized it works better that way somehow.
I like that story because it fits in with so many, as you said, accidental discoveries in science. Mm. You know, it fits in with the discovery of antibiotics and the discovery of cellophane and all of these other things that were posted out that were completely accidental. So for some reason, I like it more now. I like that.
But yeah, it takes six, from having your first injection, it's going to be 6 weeks before you're considered to be protected. And so even when it does start to be rolled out, the very first people who get it, it takes 6 weeks before they can consider themselves protected. You know, to get it rolled out to the point where we've actually got a safe level of herd immunity, I mean, I don't know how long that will take. Mm. It's certainly not going to happen before we would naturally get a third wave. And what Boris Johnson is trying to do at the moment, of course, is he's saying, well, the lockdown's ended, but then we've still got several more weeks. I mean, if you want, you know, to kill off the rest of the pensioners at Christmas, then you need to behave ourselves for a few more weeks. But then those few days at Christmas where it's not exactly, you know, everything allowed, but multiple households, including people who really should shield, will be allowed together for Christmas dinner. That is going to result inevitably mid-January with another spike. Well, I say a spike. There never spikes. Another wave.
And the issue, I think, is that it's very difficult for people, as we talked about on previous episodes, to really gauge the risk. Not that it's always all or nothing, but you can imagine it being very difficult for people to once you break the seal, as it were, over Christmas, then that'll be it, really, because people will say, well, I'm here now, I'm with the people now, I'm not going to see them again for a while, or I'm going to have to go back into lockdown, or whatever the thought process is. And this is just natural for people. So, you know, we know that that's going to be a concern, well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, even intelligent people, if they're not used to assessing risk, I've seen plenty of intelligent students, for example, A-level students, and they try and reason it. Well, I'm with people at college, so therefore, you know, I might as well just do the same thing with people socially. And they don't understand what it's all about, reducing the level of risk.
Mm.
You know, you go to college, but at the same time, you still reduce your risk and the risk of passing it on to others. If you take if you think to yourself, do I really need to do this? Like, go be close to these other people. If the answer is no, then don't. But again, it's a skill, a learned skill, to be able to assess risk.
Yeah, but of course we can understand people's need to have contact, especially people who have been. If you're in a shielding household like I am, or if you're one of those people who's just been adhering to all of the rules since March, you know, you can understand the sort of pressure build up, and people will want to sort of relieve that pressure and feel like they deserve it in a way, because they've been adhering for eight months now.
I mean, the way the brain works as well is it basically lies to you. It tries to convince you things are going to be all right for something you really want.
Well, exactly. So we hope people are safe, but we'd have to keep an eye on whether that passes during the week, and, as you mentioned, what the government ends up needing to pass it as to whether or not that causes an issue. This week, the Chancellor released the latest spending review, and it appeared that the main thing they wanted to do was to avoid looking like they're returning to austerity. So they clearly outlined plans to set up an infrastructure bank that'll be set up in the north of England, and they really emphasised that doctors and nurses will get some sort of pay rise, but all other public sector pay rises are to be frozen. So they're trying to say that austerity is not back, but it's hard to think that that's not really the case. One of the things that is really frustrating, and I'm no economist, and I'll really say that out front, but really frustrating about this sort of approach, and this happened all the way through the austerity period, so for the past 10 years, is using the national debt as an excuse for implementing austerity, as if it's a household budget that has to be balanced. And that seems to be a metaphor that can be pulled out whenever people are in need of support, or whenever we might need to borrow to fund certain activities to support communities. And really, people really buy it. And, you know, I wish we could get away from that. I wish we could get people to understand that that's not quite how it works.
It was only last week that, you know, so Boris Johnson talks about, when we talk about the need for pay rises for public sector workers, oh, can't really afford it. It was only last week he was talking about buying laser guns for soldiers. great cost. I mean, I've got a thing here as well. I mean, it is clearly austerity what they're doing. They're just doing the tried and tested technique of going, now, so we're not bringing back austerity, and then they announce a load of what are clearly austerity measures. And the one of the worrying things as well is the £27 billion figure, which needs to be reported. So in the Office for Budgetary Responsibility, they have a little line here that explains that there's going to need to be an adjustment of £27 billion in order to match day-to-day spending. And that means £27 billion of tax rises, or £27 billion of public service cuts, or some combination of the two. Now, the problem here is that in the Tory heartlands, they do not want the tax rises.
Mm.
But in the red wall Tory areas, they do not want the public service cuts. Although I've got another thing about that as well. Now, you talked about the Northern Research Group last week. The head of the Northern Research Group has actually suggested to the Chancellor, why don't we just leave all this until 2024? So what they're now talking about is deliberately not balancing the books until after the next general election. So I suppose from one point of view, they could argue, so if Labour do win, then they'll have to behave responsible. We'll then castigate them for this problem. And if we win, that's fine. We'll just deal with it then, because we'll have another 5 more years of power. And the other thing about this, this adjustment is, in terms of public service cuts anyway, which may well happen, because in another little thing related to Brexit, COVID and everything else, there's been a leak this week of you could effectively call it a damage report or a disaster report for 2021. It was released by the Cabinet Office, not released for publication. It was leaked to the media, but released to ministers. And part of it talks about the financial meltdown of councils, which, if that happens, inevitably that is going to be cuts in public services anyway. And that is just due to what they call the systemic economic collapse over the next 10 years of what is going to happen next year. This combination of COVID continuing, Brexit, severe flooding, winter flu, all of this stuff is going to form a perfect storm in the first part of next year.
Yeah, and as you said, the approach seems to be either increase taxes or to reduce public spending. I mean, it's been suggested that approach to economics, and again, I'm going to stress my lack of expertise here, but I've been reading up on it over the last few weeks. Oliver Blanchard, the former IMF chief economist, was trying to emphasize that the focus on reducing public debt, especially when it's needed to fund public services and jobs and so on, is not necessary, and suggested that public debt could have no fiscal cost. And that modern monetary theory suggests that you should run a deficit that's required or necessary enough to obtain full employment. And then at that point, you could use taxes to decrease inflation. So that idea again, that we have this credit card bill and we have to just urgently pay it off as quickly as possible.
It is a fact that, you know, when you look to independent economists, Nobel Prize winning economists, they never speak in favour of the way that this government has approached anything in the last 10 years. But you don't even have to go to new economic theory. Keynesian economics talks about the fact that you spend in the hard times and then you pay it off in the good times. It is a complete nonsense. And one simple way of looking at this, so if you freeze the pay of lower paid workers, now lower paid workers spend their wages. There isn't a lot to put aside. Some people may be able to do that. I suppose it depends where they live as well, because often public sector workers are paid according to a scale, which doesn't appreciably increase in the south of England where living costs are higher. But for a lot of public sector workers who tend to be on lower pay, what money they get gets spent, so it gets pumped back into the economy. So when you freeze their wages, not only are you reducing your tax receipts, you're reducing the money spent in the local economy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you're giving tax breaks to the wealthy, they are much more likely not to pump that back into the economy. They are having more money to set aside, and indeed will do so, in which case it's not really doing anything. If they're very wealthy, they may be wealthy enough not to pay tax at all, or you know, a token amount.
Yeah, so you can use borrowing it to stimulate the economy effectively. I've heard that phrase, that the velocity of money, that at lower levels of income, people, their money has more velocity because it moves around quicker and more. I think that's just, as I said, one thing that's always bothered me around that discussion is that metaphor gets pulled out. And although I wouldn't claim to understand the intricacies of all of the details, I do know, as you said, that if you talk to lots of economists, that metaphor and how it's applied, that we have this bill that we have to pay off.
Yeah.
But we can afford to give really lax contracts to, you know, COVID providers and so on, which we'll come to later.
I mean, you can look at it another way. So if the government want to talk about it in terms of personal finances, you could look at it this way. Young couple, when they're buying their first house, particularly if it's a house like the family home, it's the first time they're going to buy a house that they intend to live there for decades. So a lot of young couples may well mortgage to the max, knowing full well that they're relatively early in their careers, as long as they feel stable in those careers, their wages are going to go up. But the mortgage repayments, unless interest rates do something silly, which has occasionally happened, are not going to go up that much. So their payments effectively as a proportion of their income comes down over time, and the value of their house goes up. Whereas if you are, you know, giving it to wealthy people, that's almost like spending it on holidays and other frivolous things where you never get a return back. You know, you get a return if you effectively spend money on lower paid workers, which you don't if you're giving it away in dodgy contracts where we don't even get a face mask out of it.
Yeah, and a lot of the reason why I bring this up is that this discussion, I say discussion, so I'm talking about comment section type discussion, came up in the context of the other controversy around the spending review, which was the reduction in the foreign aid budget. So people were arguing for that reduction, saying that, well, we don't want to borrow money to give it to other countries. But if we stay off that point for a second and just break down what's happened. So Baroness Sugg, who was the Minister for Sustainable Development, Overseas Territories in the Caribbean, resigns from the government. There's David Cameron, Tony Blair, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Nobel Laureate Malala Yousafzai, sorry, I always pronounce that name incorrectly, have all come out against it. And, you know, the point raised was that because it's a percentage of GDP, and if GDP goes down, in a sense, we can't afford to pay as much. Well, we won't pay as much because it's a percentage value.
Yes.
And to break down as well what it gets spent on, because, you know, the comments around people supporting it, saying, well, we give it to this country and they have a space program or they have nuclear weapons or whatever it is, 15% of the budget goes on humanitarian aid or crisis relief, and the rest is focused on strategic goals like vaccinating children from preventable diseases, helping them go to school, helping them work their way out of poverty, providing medical care. So it's interesting because I've been trying to dig into it in a bit more detail just to understand, I guess, the value of it was just articulated there a second ago in terms of what it does, but in a global sense, where we sit. And so we know that the UK are hosting the G7. And so a lot of the comments saying we shouldn't do this really focused on the UK's position as a leader in foreign aid. Did you pick up anything else around it?
I mean, in terms of the G7, we are at this moment in time, as a proportion of our GDP, we technically spend more than any other nation in the G7. Now, Germany are only slightly behind. Now, there are a couple of ways to look at it. So Ian Blackford, for example, mentioned, he linked it to COVID, which I thought was a good point. I thought he was floundering a bit until he made this good point, that COVID isn't going to go away. It's all right us having a vaccination program. If we do not eradicate it globally, it never goes away. Even from the UK, because people will still visit the UK or go to a place that has COVID still and come back to the UK. But it is one of those things. First of all, the Conservatives made a manifesto promise to retain the 0.7%. So that's another broken manifesto promise. Secondly, it does improve. We're hemorrhaging influence at the moment over the last few years, and we're going to continue to do so. This was something, and people need to understand it. In a sense, it is an act of charity, but it's not like an act of charity you or me engage in, where it's effectively anonymous. The people who benefit from our donations don't really know it's us. When it comes to foreign aid, they absolutely do, because it's also a PR exercise.
And I assume strategically, in terms of as well where and how we provide that aid would be considered as well. So what the reciprocal benefit to us might be.
Yes, we get a lot of control in deciding exactly where it goes. And it does boost our influence around the world. A lot of the world, it has to be said, are not necessarily naturally our best friends. But then I do also, you know, not in the name of some spurious balance, have to accept Boris Johnson. I thought, and I don't say this very often, I may never have said this, I thought in he did give a good account by suggesting that even by reducing it to not, he didn't talk about that specifically because it's not official, well, it wasn't official government policy at the time, by reducing it to 0.5%, distressingly, that still makes it one of the highest contributions in the G7. Germany would now be clearly much higher, but the rest of the G7 is lower than that as a proportion of GDP.
Yeah, we would still be up there. That's so. For the sake of balance, I was trying to look for arguments against having a high proportion of, or I mean, having such a high proportion.
I don't think there was an argument for this cutting of it. Or I see it as purely, it's something that appeals to the xenophobic Brexiteers that are part of their support base. That's it. I see it purely in those terms. That being said, it is stunningly difficult to make a serious landing, you know, telling blow against such a policy when they can still say we're still going to remain the second highest contributor in as a world proportion of GDP, because that unfortunately is a fact. Because other countries, Japan, France, the United States, for example, as a proportion of GDP, contribute less even with this reduction.
Because that's a point you make where you think it's appealing to a certain section of the base, because I was wondering what might have precipitated this, really, other than that. So there was a report earlier in the year which suggested that certain proportion of foreign aid does go missing into tax havens, particularly in the countries that are most dependent on foreign aid. So if they're so dependent that foreign aid makes more than 3% of their GDP, then they have a higher tendency for some of that money to go missing. That's the only thing that I could find. And of course, that isn't an argument to say that we shouldn't have foreign aid or to suggest that reducing it would actually change that, because it wouldn't. But I couldn't find anything other than the supposition, as you said, that it's to appeal to a certain proportion of the base to say we've ended free movement, so we're not letting people come into the country anymore, and we're also not giving money to those foreign people. But the argument sort of falls down when the money is not being redirected towards local, when they're still arguing against feeding school children.
That's exactly it. They're still not going to provide the pay rises that should be, because it also has to be in real terms public, because Boris Johnson kept talking about we've brought in above inflationary pay rises. No, you haven't. If you look at the 10 years of Conservative government, over 10 years now, in real terms, public sector pay is still below when Labour were last in power. It's still below that level. It has never caught up. And it is obviously with the next round of pay freezes, which will last potentially for a few more years, it's going to fall further behind. And yet we've still had the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister has still allowed Dominic Cummings I don't know what he's doing with that £100 million for Operation Moonshot. Operation Moonshot may have been shelved, but the money is still there for him to do on something. I don't know what his plans are for that. We're not really hearing a lot about that. And also the fact that last week he was talking about buying laser guns. You know, which, given that we don't want to weaken our military as such, but do we really need to go buying laser guns that may or may not work? And it's not like we want to be going out trying to behave aggressively around the world for moral as well as practical reasons, quite frankly, at the moment.
Yeah, I don't want to go back to an earlier point, but when I talked about the metaphor of the budget, but the other example of rhetoric that I think for some reason it really works with people, but I don't really understand why it does, is that idea of comparing the public sector to the private sector. So they would say, well, you know, the private sector is not going to do so well over the next few years, so we also have to cut the public sector, as if that's a reason why we should. I mean, it just doesn't make sense, but for some reason it sounds like it makes sense on first glance, if that makes, and people buy into it.
For a party who ideologically don't like the public sector, I suppose the reasoning would be they don't want the idea. The idea for a conservative in the ideal world is the private sector. It would be an employer's market. They don't like the idea that an employee may go and choose to work for the public sector over a private company, because then that means those private companies have to pay higher wages or something like that to be able to recruit. They'd like to be able to look after business owners by giving them a ready source of employees who will be so desperate to work that they will work for very low wages, potentially poor working conditions as well. So they don't want public sector to look attractive as a source of employment. They almost want it to be, you know, the place people go and get a job when they can't get a job in the private sector, I think is how they see it in their heads.
Yeah, it's the second prong in the reality of how the government actually treats the private sector. The first one is the idea that the private sector is the area where you get efficiency and great ideas, and if you leave everything to the private sector, the market will sort everything out, until of course something happens and then companies need massive bailouts from the government.
Yes.
And then the second prong to that, as you said, is we have to make sure that the private sector doesn't look less attractive than the public sector, all of which just completely dismantles that argument around privatization of certain aspects of our economy. This week there was a lot of discussion around the Priti Patel bullying review. There are various strands to this discussion, not least the review in itself. One of the focuses being when it first was leaked, because it wasn't released, was that the PM wanted it to be more palatable and was intervening. There was the sad irony that it was released on Anti-Bullying Week. Then after we found out about it, Sir Alex Allen, the Prime Minister's advisor on ministerial standards, quit his post because he concluded that Priti Patel had breached the ministerial code, and even if it was unintentional, obviously he wasn't happy that she wasn't sanctioned about it. So Johnson said his excuse was that she was unaware that she was breaching the ministerial code, but Alex Allen said that she'd been asked many times to tone down her behaviour. And I just thought I'd give you, Phil, a few different examples from different sections of the media as to how this was reported. So see if you can guess where this is from. Most Britons back Priti's hard line against the leftist snobs. Then in the same article, they equated the report with when Angela Rayner called Conservative MPs scum in Parliament. What do you think?
I mean, that sounds like the Daily Mail, but could equally be the Daily Express.
That was Telegraph.
Really?
Here we have another one. Was Priti Patel a bully, or is it just a word lazy gits use to dodge criticism?
That's got to be a tabloid.
That was the Sun.
That was the Sun, yeah.
And then, bully Priti Patel's Home Office has sacked 12 staff in 2 years for bullying.
There's not too many that could possibly be. I'll say the Mirror for that.
The Mirror, yes, you're right. So then, as a consequence of all of this, the Institute for Government said that the handling of the inquiry has fatally undermined the ministerial code. And because the manner of Johnson's defence will now cause even greater problems. And of course, the issue is that As far as I understand how the ministerial code works, it was the Prime Minister who decides when an investigation is needed, and he also decides how to respond. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
That sounds like a very independent process.
The thing about this is, so part of the report says that it may have been inadvertent from Priti Patel. Now, there's two things to say about this. First of all, is I do not understand how any reasonable person could think that Priti Patel, who does not have Tourette's syndrome, because people keep trying to do that, thinks that shouting and screaming and swearing at people is not going to upset them. I can think of no context, even trying to be as generous as I can, as charitable as I can, where Priti Patel could scream and swear at someone without the specific intent of upsetting them. And the second thing is that Sir Alex's report concludes about the lack of evidence that she'd been warned about this. Now, the reason for that is because he tried to and was absolutely forbidden to discuss with Sir Philip Rutnam, who is the former permanent secretary of the Home Office, who resigned and is taking Priti Patel to an employment tribunal for bullying him. So he would have said, and indeed he has since said, that she was told, he passed on these concerns to her, and had he been interviewed, that would have featured in the report.
Yeah, he came out actually, although he had previously said he wouldn't comment further after he made a statement a while back. He did make or release a statement saying that he had warned her, just to contradict or, I guess, clarify that aspect of the report as we understood it. And I think one of the things about this, and we have to say, I don't know whether she engaged in this behavior or not. So talking about it in a completely hypothetical, completely hypothetical perspective, this really goes to workplace culture and the idea that certain types of people succeed, and that, you know, if we take the headlines, for example, this approach really bothers me. And also, I joked earlier on about the comments that people made in support of her. Now, let's just say, for example, she did engage in that behavior. Characterizing it as that she's tough or that she just has high expectations doesn't excuse what's alleged to have gone on in the work environment. And the idea that work should be some sort of constant resilience test, that you're constantly pushed to your limits, and that if you can't survive, that it's your own weakness. There's no way or reason that our work environment has to be like that, even if you have one of the toughest jobs in the country. In fact, it could suggest that a way to define or determine someone's character is their ability to withstand those pressures and not engage in that sort of behavior.
Well, the fact of the matter is, some Conservatives have been trying to suggest, Ian Duncan Smith was one of them, they just pushed her to her limits. They're so feckless, these people that she has working for her. And then the question was inevitably levelled, okay, so one, how come previous Home Secretaries have not felt the need to scream and swear at those very same staff? And two, how come other members of the Cabinet have not felt the need to scream and swear at their staff? Because bear in mind, Priti Patel has form on this. She was a member of Theresa May's cabinet, and the bullying allegations came through in a completely different department as well. This is purely Priti Patel. It's not any of the rest of them, and it's not any other person who's been in the same ministry that she is in. And so it's absolutely ridiculous to place this on anyone other than Priti Patel. She is the common factor throughout all of this.
Even take away or move away from her alleged actions and whether or not she should be sacked, I think it says a lot of how willing people are to defend those sorts of actions and characterize them as toughness or exactly the type of steely determination that you need. All of these really sort of
Which they are anything but. I mean, the people that, you know, people in this country will generally regard as great leaders in history have never had a culture of bullying about them.
nor is it needed.
In fact, quite the reverse. Often you find that they've taken, you know, that these are the sort of people who take the time to talk to people and understand the issues and make decisions based on that instead of just going in and screaming and shouting like Malcolm Tucker.
Do you think the willingness to defend those sorts of actions from so many of the cabinet speaks to their type of attitude or how they, not necessarily that they behave the same way?
No, I don't think so. At first I thought maybe. I think it's purely because politics is now so partisan, so tribal, that they have to do this. Because I'll tell you what I noticed in Prime Minister's questions this week. Keir Starmer used all six of his questions to tackle this issue of the ministerial code. And he went through one by one how Boris Johnson had broken his own promise by virtue of the fact his members of his government had breached every single aspect of the ministerial code that Boris Johnson personally identified. And he got a lot of cheers from it. Now, you would expect that from his own side. Mm-hmm. But what you didn't get was counter jeers from the Tory benches. In fact, at one point, it got a great laugh, including from some Conservative MPs. So I think those Conservative MPs who, remember, are there, they're trying to pretend there's like hundreds of them and trying to sort of cheer on Boris Johnson. And yet they were stunningly silent at these accusations being levelled at the Prime Minister because fundamentally they know that it's wrong.
He reacted differently.
That was my take home from that.
No, that is an interesting point because, as you said, there wasn't any attempt to show support, even indirectly, for those things. But his response was telling in a way, again, to the extent that we can read into it, because he got quite flustered.
Yes.
And he didn't respond very well. And it sort of suggests that maybe he doesn't cope very well. And again, I'm not alleging he behaves in any particular way, but it was interesting, I thought. And I do wish more people would watch PMQs because you would see those things. You don't see them in one sitting, you don't see a lot, or you can read in too much into one PMQs. But when you watch them a lot,
yeah,
you do get a sense of people's character and get a sense of how they might behave behind closed doors because the mask slips a little bit sometimes. The Good Law Project have brought to court judicial reviews around procurement for COVID supplies. And they have recently found out that these reviews have been brought to the next stage with hearing to take place in December. Some of the challenges have been upheld, while some of them are being appealed with the attempt to try to get them also upheld. I believe there were 5 complaints and they want to see if they can get all 5 being upheld. But of course, this is all around the fact that it's come to light that at least £150 million has been wasted on unusable PPE. So there's the wastage aspect, but there's also the issue around how procurement was handled. And we have 2 examples of that I can bring up. So one is Adania Capital, which there was £252 million contract, and there was a £156 million worth of supplies that can't be used by the NHS. And then we just today found out that Matt Hancock's neighbour got a contract for COVID test kits after sending a message on WhatsApp. And if you saw in that story, there was that lovely picture of Matt Hancock and his friend in the pub, but both of whom have later denied knowing each other very well.
It's, yeah, I mean, these cases, even the Good Law Project admit, and they've got another one going with the Runnymede Trust as well, in terms of senior public appointments who have control of a great deal, of billions, in fact, of public expenditure. And they've been given the go-ahead for full hearings next year. And even they sort of accept that it's not going to reverse anything. All it can possibly do is force the government to behave better in future if that behaviour is deemed unlawful. One of the things, again, that came up with PMQs when Keir Starmer was tackling the issue of these dodgy contracts, particularly in respect to conflicts of interest, is that Johnson said, well, this will, you know, if there's any conflicts of interest, this will become apparent with the details of the contracts, to which, first of all, you know, there's several points about that. First of all, well, when the government give out these contracts, by law, they're supposed to publish the details of the contracts within 30 days, and they are not doing this. Mm-hmm. We're only just starting to get some of these contracts released, and there's quite a lot of them that were awarded months ago that are still being kept secret. And the second point to make is, when they are published, we are identifying the conflicts of interest. That's why there's on a weekly basis, there are several new ones emerging. It's almost getting to a daily basis. Every time a contract is published, a conflict of interest is being identified. You know, when, for example, Keir Starmer mentioned earlier this week the issue of someone, an advisor who is involved in the process of allocating contracts, represented a group that specializes in lobbying the government, and several of that group's clients were awarded government contracts. So the conflict of interest is obvious. So it is emerging in the details. They just don't really want to talk about it. It is very much like a raid on the government, on the country's coffers.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have described it as it's a very deliberate process. They know they've got a certain amount of time before they're gone, and they're just funneling out as much money as they can.
Yeah, I mean, that links back to what we talked about debt. And, you know, debt is never brought up in the context of this spending. And yet, as you said, from what we can see, due to all the conflicts of interest, all the wastage, all the scale of the contracts being awarded to companies that didn't exist and were just literally set up, or companies that don't even make medical supplies, pest companies. This company was a company that made plastic containers for takeaways. Then they said, oh, we'll make some vials for COVID tests. Did they get the vials? Were they usable? We have no idea. And this is, of course, running up massive bills on the public purse. And then where the cuts come are in terms of people's pay.
Yeah, and ultimately, if it is found that the government has behaved unlawfully, we know what will happen to the people who benefited from this. Not a thing. Boris Johnson will again say that the courts are biased. He may well be gone by then, who knows. But he'll just say the courts are biased, and this is why we need to stop judges being independent. And nothing will happen. At best, the government may be under more pressure to not carry on doing it. But the money will have already been stolen, effectively, and added to future bills. Because what people need to understand, of course, is the government, in terms of its spending, has a certain amount that it acquires itself from tax receipts, corporation tax and so on, business rates, and then borrowing, and that's what it's got to spend. And the more we borrow, the higher our debts, the higher, the more money has to be spent on servicing that debt, you know, paying out on the bonds, and the less we have for public services.
Yeah.
So this is a problem that is being added to us for years to come. And they will, you know, if Labour do get to form a government after the next general election, it's still a big if, they will undoubtedly have the nerve to complain when Labour decide to then balance the books that Labour are not behaving economically sensibly because they're putting up taxes.
Yeah, well, that's the strategy. There's a good article called The Two Santa Strategy, where conservatives in the US realised that they needed to change tack because they realised that Democratic, or in this case left-wing parties, were considered to be like Santa, because they could give away, in a sense, money, because they would increase public spending, they would increase support network for people, and that was seen as a good thing by the electorate, and the Republicans didn't have anything to counter that with, so they needed to create a new dynamic whereby they could, on the one hand, eliminate the ability of the left to do that, and they did that by running up the deficit. And the other hand, changed the narrative by creating what they called supply side economics. So that was where they created essentially trickle down economics. So if we give money to businesses will create employment there and raise the stock market and so on. And so they, with that single move, they did two things, as you said. they reduced the ability of left parties to actually invest in infrastructure because they were left with massive debt. And then they appeared to be the parties of business and investment because they would raise the stock market and invest in companies and large donors and so on who didn't need the money.
So, I'm sure ordinary working people cheer every time the stock market's up.
Oh, yeah. Did you not know that it hit 50,000 or 30,000 or whatever Donald Trump said the other day?
Yes.
In his great speech.
Like stock market's up. That's fantastic. Well done.
Sort of tangentially related.
1% of people who care about that.
Well, I was going to say tangentially related to figures that don't affect your life, but you feel like they really should. Matt Hancock was found to have spent £47,528 on takeaways earlier this year. So when you get annoyed at a Labour or other party manifesto promise to increase public spending, just be aware that there was a lot of spending happening. It just wasn't happening on the public.
Well, yeah, it's not happening in a way that invests in the country for the future. This is the problem. And again, they're still promising it. They're still promising great infrastructure projects. But I just have to keep looking at this. Boris Johnson has been prime minister for about a year and a half now, and he keeps promising great things. And what has he actually delivered? And then if people try and say, well, give him a chance, we say, well, didn't he have a chance when he was mayor of London, when he also promised a great many impressive and engineering projects? And what London has got out of it, apart from the closure of a load of TfL officers and the police stations and so on, was a cable car across the Thames, which is probably the least efficient way of getting across the Thames. I'm told by people who've been on it, it's very nice.
Should we talk about the 5 mile lorry queues in Kent because of the Brexit border checks?
Why not? And that was a test for a system that actually works. So that was France's test.
Yeah, they have it in place. And that was only part of the system as well. That was only
that was just testing the software.
Yeah, I think that was only the checks for people crossing the border as opposed to all the other checks that would have to be put in place for imports and other things.
Veterinary checks and so on.
Yeah.
And
so that bodes well.
Well, I mean, we don't even see. When I first saw it, I was mentioning this on my channel. When I first saw it, at first I thought I was a bit surprised about this because we haven't got a system to test what's going on. And then I found out, it's the French testing theirs. Okay, I see. And something that people don't always think, because so our government are talking about just waving everything through across ours, because that's how Brexit works. We're going to control our borders by just letting anyone through. Because we haven't got the system set in place to do any checks. But so people may be imagining, well, that means we're going to struggle to export. Okay, that could hit businesses. I don't know why they think that's okay, but okay. But I keep going on about we're going to struggle to get the food and medicines and chemicals that we need into the country. Well, no, we won't, because they're just going to wave them through. But that's not how it works, because the lorries that are going to bring them, how it works is the lorries pick up a load in the UK, take it to the EU. They don't come back, because that's for every moment a lorry is on the road and there's nothing in it, the company's losing money. So they pick up another load and they bring that back. So if the lorries that are supposed to be bringing us the things are actually stuck in an outbound queue for days, they're not bringing that stuff back. And the other problem we've got is there's going to be a lot of EU lorry drivers, we're told, who don't want to do the UK run because they don't want to be stuck in a queue for days, having to use a portaloo that, although the government have announced they're putting portaloos down the roads in Kent, they haven't said anything about whether they're going to clean them on a regular basis or not. That's going to be interesting.
That's just details.
And also they say they're only going to apply them reactively. So they're going to take them away when they think they're not needed, because they don't want to encourage lorry drivers to stop on the hard shoulder to have a pee. Whereas in reality, if a lorry driver, as my partner was saying, if a lorry driver wants to have a pee, they'll pull over and piss up the side of their lorry. But
I got to stop on that, because that's just the weirdest logic I've ever heard. They don't want to leave them there because that might encourage. That's just some twisted version of, we can't have unemployment benefit or universal credit because it'll just encourage people not to work, but it's just twisted into portaloo form.
Yes.
We can't have infrastructure to support people who need a vital function because it might encourage them to actually engage in that function. I don't know. That's completely tangential, but just it's so weird.
So, yeah, we may struggle to get EU lorry drivers. Some of them may go, I'm not doing that one. Send me to Belgium. Whereas, and then the other problem is for British lorry drivers. So at the moment, although there's a lot of optimism for a deal, we don't know that we're getting one. Now, in the event of a no deal, British lorry drivers need permits to be able to go to the EU. And we will have enough permits in a no deal scenario for a quarter of our fleet. So that's a 75% reduction in British haulage capacity in the event of a no deal. And even with a deal, the haulage industry believes they still won't get as many permits as we have right now. So our fleet is going to be reduced in capacity, effective capacity. So we're the government waving things through may reduce the level of chaos, but it's not going to avert it.
Of course, the situation changes by the day. So a few days ago, Rishi Sunak said we shouldn't sign a deal at any price. So we're back to that rhetoric. But today, Ursula von der Leyen said that the EU is prepared for a no-deal Brexit. So to what extent we should take those sound bites as an indicator of where we are, we don't know.
No, I mean, at the moment, what is being said is being said for political purposes from both sides. I wouldn't, when you get to this stage of a negotiation, it's often the case. I mean, this is very, very different because normally in negotiations, you have two willing parties who want to converge their interests, not diverge. At any point at this stage, when you go into the final stage, obviously both sides like to talk tough and like to talk as if they're willing to leave without anything at all. It is going to be rhetoric on both sides. So I'm just, at the moment, I'm in the mode of just waiting to see now on this. It will either happen or it won't. And I don't know when it will happen or not, because we've gone past all the deadlines already. So we'll just have to wait this one out.
As a final point, what do you think are the odds that when it comes down to it, we just end up with some sort of extension or extension with a different name?
In terms of an actual extension, I think that's politically impossible. Now, I've said the
deal that maybe replicates an extension.
Yeah, the thing that so getting a deal and calling it an implementation period, which is identical to the transition period. My issue with that is I do not know whether enough of his MPs will wear it, and the ones who won't, how belligerent and aggressive they will be in challenging Johnson over that. So for me, I absolutely believe that Boris Johnson would do that. And he will, in terms of conning the public, it will work like a charm. He'll just call it an implementation period. This is the sort of thing that happens with trade deal. Yes, it is. In reality, it'll be bogus in our case. The reason why trade agreements generally have an implementation period is it's to implement systems that don't currently exist. Whereas for us, yes, I mean, we don't have the systems in place to deal with those customs, but how long do you do it for? Because we're not likely to have them in place for several years. But will his MPs wear it?
That is, yeah, I think, as you said, they could pass it in the public, but they need the messaging, because they need to snuff out the ERG saying Brexit in name only, or whatever their slogan might be.
Or even just triggering a leadership challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we shall see. It's all going down to the wire this Christmas. The 2020 episode of The Human Race is about to reach its conclusion. How will the apocalypse end? How will Brexit transpire? Will the virus come under control? And with that, we will leave it this week. Thank you very much for joining me again, Phil.
Thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure.